All right, so welcome everybody. This is BIO-231, and it's November 1st. We have to talk a couple minutes about autonomic nervous system, but then we're gonna move into special senses, which is chapter 16. And we have our next test scheduled for November 17th, chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, and 19. So that's what's gonna be on the 17th of November. So we gotta pick the pace up. Well, not really. It's just two more chapters we gotta cover for the next test. That's not too bad. All right, so we're gonna draw the sympathetic outflow pathway. So let's compare the parasympathetic and sympathetic in terms of its general outflow pathways. How many neurons does it take to get from CNS to effector organ for any autonomic pathway?
Two.
It takes two. That's right. What are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? Where do autonomic neurons go, whether they're sympathetic or parasympathetic? Do they go to skeletal muscle, for instance? No, they don't go to skeletal muscle. Where do they go? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and?
Glands.
And glands. That's right. Okay. So the parasympathetic nervous system could be characterized by what kind of outflow it has, which is what? Where do parasympathetic nerves leave the central nervous system? That's right. They're far apart. They're part from the brain and part from the sacral region, so they're craniosacral outflow, right? Now, what about sympathetic? Thoracolumbar, 'cause they leave from the spinal cord only from the thoracic regions and lumbar regions. All right, then you gotta know what levels they are. All right, so we're drawing sympathetic outflow right here. So here we got spinal cord, right? And then we got the gray matter of the spinal cord, kinda like this. So where are the nerve cell bodies of autonomic neurons at? In the lateral horn, right? So sympathetic nerves. Then how does the nerve leave the spinal cord? A root. What kind of root? How many roots are there? There are two. There's dorsal root and ventral root. Which root is the motor root? It's the ventral root, right? So it's gonna leave the ventral root. So here's VR, ventral root. All right, so that means this here is the dorsal root. What's the structure in the dorsal root that forms a little bulge right here? Yeah, the DRG, dorsal root ganglia. Then these roots come together and form a mixed nerve right there, and that's what we call the spinal nerve. That's a spinal nerve. Okay, and then the spinal nerve is gonna bifurcate into these two divisions. Now, what are these things? Yeah, these are the rami, right? The dorsal ramus and ventral ramus, and I gotta put a little A right there to make sure you don't get that mixed up with the root. All right, but that's just a regular peripheral nerve. So, the root over here, this ventral root is, what's the function of this ventral root? 100% motor, right? There's no sensory. What about the dorsal root? 100% sensory. Those roots are not mixed. What about the spinal nerve? What's the function of the spinal nerve? It's mixed. What about a ramus? It's mixed as well, right? Only the roots are efferent or afferent only. All right, but since we're talking about sympathetic outflow, that sympathetic, the preganglionic sympathetic neuron doesn't go into the rami. It leaves the spinal nerve, and where does it go? It goes into the sympathetic chain ganglia, right? And then you have to know this preganglionic fiber right here, is it myelinated or not myelinated? It is myelinated. So this rami communicantes is what color?
White.
So that's the white ramus communicantes, and then this neuron might synapse on the postganglionic cell, and if it does, right, then it might reenter that spinal nerve. And what about this postganglionic cell? Is it myelinated?
No.
No, it's unmyelinated. So what color is this gonna be? So this is the gray ramus communicantes right there, and then that unmyelinated fiber is gonna track with the dorsal ramus or ventral ramus to get to the effector organ. But what's another possibility? Maybe this preganglionic fiber is going to pass right through the sympathetic chain and go to a collateral ganglion someplace. All right, or prevertebral, it's in front of the vertebral column. And so this has always got a name. What's the general name of this nerve that takes a preganglionic fiber all the way to a collateral ganglia? That's the splanchnic nerve. So I'm going to put SP, and for splanchnic makes it different than spinal nerve right there. All right, and then the postganglionic cell is going to go to some effector organ someplace. And so I think that's everything you have to know. Except, what's the neurotransmitter that's used at the sympathetic ganglion? You should probably know that. That is acetylcholine. What's the neurotransmitter for this fiber right here? What fiber is that, as a matter of fact? That's what, the postganglionic, right? Here's the preganglionic, here's the postganglionic. What's the neurotransmitter for sympathetic systems at the postganglionic cell? It's going to be norepinephrine. All right, so the neurotransmitters are a little bit different. All right, so that's where we left off last time. So that would be really helpful if you could draw that out, I'm sure. All right, so if we look at the slides that I have, let me turn some of these lights off. That one I like on. Maybe I'll turn these two off. Okay, if we look at a outflow pathway, there are two general kinds of outflow pathways. There's somatic versus autonomic, right? Somatic, and where do somatic motor nerves go? Skeletal muscle, that's right, skeletal muscle. So if we look at the slide on the left, right, we see a bunch of neurons, outflow pathways from this background over here. Looks kind of green to me. This means central nervous system. If it's a white background, that just means peripheral nervous system. So some, all these nerves start in the central, end up in the peripheral nervous system. For somatic nervous system, how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ? But for somatic pathway, and is somatic voluntary or involuntary? It's voluntary. So a voluntary pathway is how many neurons? Just one. And it's always going to use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter, stimulating at the neuromuscular junction, causing the skeletal muscle to contract, right? It's always going to be excitatory on that skeletal muscle. We'll never inhibit that skeletal muscle. But if it is an autonomic pathway that we see down over here, what are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? You got sympathetic and parasympathetic. Now, how would you characterize these in everyday kinds of activities? What would be sympathetic? One way to characterize sympathetic. It is fight or flight nervous system. And parasympathetic would be rest and digest, right, when you're in a kind of a calm mood. All right, so sympathetic is characterized by a divergence of neurons. So when the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, all sympathetic nerves are activated. All sympathetic systems are activated. All right, but the parasympathetic is still discrete. I don't see any divergence of signals. The parasympathetic nerves can go to one organ without affecting other organs by increasing parasympathetic tone. That's not so with the sympathetic nervous system. All right, the so we got, how many neurons does it take for an autonomic pathway to get from central nervous system to effector organ, which is what? Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, or gland? It takes two. You've got the preganglionic that's myelinated and the postganglionic that is not myelinated. All right, the fiber for sympathetic, the preganglionic fiber is relatively short. The postganglionic is relatively long for sympathetic. For parasympathetic, the preganglionic is long and the postganglionic is relatively short. Okay. The difference in neurotransmitters for sympathetic postganglionic fiber is norepinephrine. The postganglionic parasympathetic is acetylcholine, like at the ganglion. All right, so that's a similarity. All right, now here is the last little bit of complicating news that I have for you, the last detail that we had to talk about. Okay, I guess I'm going to close this door here. All right, so for an autonomic pathway, it usually takes how many neurons? To go from CNS to effector organ for an autonomic pathway? Is two, but there is what? Usually an exception to every rule. Here is the exception, but it's an important exception. And it has to do with increasing sympathetic tone all over your body because of the adrenal medulla. Now, what about the adrenal medulla? What part of the adrenal gland is that, if it's the medulla? Is it the superficial part or the deep part? Medulla is the deep part, right? So here is the adrenal cortex, which is the superficial part, but we're not interested in that. We're interested in this deep region right here, which is the adrenal medulla. And the adrenal gland is not shown where it exists, but it's right on top of the kidneys. And your kidneys are located in your posterior muscles of your back, pretty much. They're not in the abdominal cavity. And there is a neuron that goes to the adrenal medulla, and it is a sympathetic fiber. It's a preganglionic sympathetic fiber that releases acetylcholine within the adrenal medulla. And there are cells within the adrenal medulla that do not send electrical impulses like this postganglionic fiber does, but when they are stimulated, they directly release norepinephrine and epinephrine into the interstitial space, and then those compounds get picked up by capillaries in the adrenal medulla and enter the blood. And after they're in the blood, where do they go? They go everywhere in the body. All right, and epinephrine and norepinephrine then can bind to receptors on target tissues everywhere in the body that have those receptors. So the adrenal medulla can increase sympathetic tone where? All over the body. The heart, glands, intestines, right? So again, that kind of shows you that sympathetic activity does what? It just activates everything in your body, increases sympathetic tone everywhere in your body. So this system right here, including the adrenal gland, is a little bit different because I only see one neuron. The cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic neuron right here in most sympathetic outflow pathways, but they're not really neurons, right? These are acting like an endocrine gland secreting a hormone into the blood, and those hormones would be epinephrine and norepinephrine. But you're saying, now wait a second, I thought norepinephrine was a neurotransmitter. Right? So actually, that's not a really good idea to think of norepinephrine being released by the cells of the adrenal medulla as a hormone. You should actually consider them a neurohormone, because these cells are acting like what? The postganglionic fiber in a typical outflow pathway. So this shows you the interface between the nervous system and the endocrine system, right? And in a lot of courses, you don't study the nervous system by itself and the endocrine system by itself, but they are integrated together in a number of locations. The adrenal medulla is one. It's really what? The neuroendocrine system that function together to control your body. Right, and these neurohormones, epinephrine and norepinephrine, when they are released into the blood, they have a longer duration of action than norepinephrine when it's released from the postganglionic cell. So if you're driving down the freeway and all of a sudden a semi-tractor trailer truck is going to like cut you off and smash you into the guardrail, and you're sure it's going to happen, and you slam on the brakes, and by some miracle you survive, all right, but you sure you were going to die just an instant ago, right? All of these hormones now have been neurohormones, epinephrine, norepinephrine, have been released into the blood, and what happens? Your heart rate is increased, but not only that, but the force of contraction of the heart is what? Increased. It's like pounding outside of your chest, right? And what about your pupils? Are they constricted or dilated? Oh, they're really big. They're dilated, right? So you can really see what's happening, right? And your airways are dilated. Right, and the effect of these compounds in the blood lasts for a long time. Your heart rate is going to be elevated for, you know, a half hour, right? Minutes, not just seconds, as a result of that. And that's just how it is in the when those hormones get into the blood. All right, so that's an interesting outflow pathway. You have another slide that shows that. All right, this one right here. So this is for sympathetic outflow. You have the cell body in the lateral horn, leaves the ventral root, right? Goes into the spinal nerve, and then through the white ramus communicantes, but it doesn't synapse in the sympathetic chain ganglia. It passes right through, going through the adrenal medulla. So what's the name of this nerve? General name of this nerve that passes the preganglionic fiber right through the sympathetic chain? That is a splanchnic nerve. And here's where it synapses on these cells, what we call chromaffin cells. They're not really neurons because they don't carry electrical impulses anywhere. But when they become stimulated by the preganglionic fiber, they directly release epinephrine and norepinephrine, which gets picked up by this capillary and then delivered everywhere in the body, increasing sympathetic activity everywhere in the body. All right, so this is the outflow pathway. So for this adrenal medullary system, there's only the preganglionic fiber. There is no postganglionic fiber. It's replaced by these cells of the adrenal medulla. All right, so that's it for sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. Anybody have any questions on that? No. Okay. So we can close this down and move on to the next chapter, which is pretty fun. I actually take way too much time on this next chapter, which is, what, 15? 16. All right. Which is special senses. Okay, that's looking good there. Let me open up the Word file. Okay, so this chapter has to do with special senses, which means you got to know something about non-special senses. You have special senses and then another kind that aren't special. And what are the kind that aren't special called? Not special. That's what I said. Okay, you can't say that. They are what we call general. So the two categories are general versus special senses. All right, so in order to have a sense, what do you need in your body? What physical apparatus do you need to sense some modality of energy, like light, for instance? What do you need? You need a receptor, a photoreceptor that you have in your eyes, for instance, right? In order to feel pressure on your skin, you need a tactile sensor in your skin, right? Or if you need to hear sound vibrations, you need to have vibration sensors in your ears. So you need sensors to appreciate different modalities of energy. So the difference between general and special senses is that a receptor for a general sense you have everywhere in the body, all over the place. And temperature is a general sense because you have sensors for temperature all over your body. If I take an ice cube and I put it on your earlobe, can you tell? Absolutely. If I put it on your belly button, can you tell it's an ice cube? Yeah. Or your elbow, can you tell? Yeah. Kneecap. Right, anywhere where you put that ice cube, you can tell that it's cold. So temperature is what we call a general sense, right? But there are five important special senses. And a special sense means that you don't have receptors all over the body. You just have them in one, maybe two locations. And it's a relatively sophisticated organ that allows you to sense that particular modality of energy. Like, for instance, light. If I have a flashlight and I shine it in your ear, can you see it? What about your belly button? Can you see it? What about your kneecap? No. Where can you see light if I shine this light on you? Only your eyes, right? And you only have two of those, so vision is a special sense. And another sense is taste. The name for taste is the gustatory sense. So if I take a sugar cube and put it on your kneecap, can you taste it? No. What about your fingertips? No. Ear? No. Eyeball? The only place where you can taste it is where? Only on your tongue. So again, that's a special sense because you can only taste things in that one location. So vision and taste. Now, what about a tuning fork, which is going to produce sound, right? If I hold that tuning fork up against like your toes, will you hear anything?
No.
It's only where? Through your ears. And you have two ears, so that's a special sense. So, what about perfume? Can you smell with your fingertips? No, only with your nose. So, the sense of olfaction is a special sense. So you got vision, hearing, gustation, olfaction, those are special senses, and two more having to do with equilibrium. And those are in your ear, and those two senses are what we call angular equilibrium versus linear equilibrium. And we're going to talk about those kind of at the end of the chapter. All right, so let's talk about these senses right here, namely olfaction. So what kind of sense is olfaction? Yeah, that's smell. All right, I just want to clear all these spelling mistakes. Okay. Let's go back to here, and I will save it. Okay, so olfaction is the sense of smell. All right, so there have to be airborne molecules that we call odors that bind to receptors in your nose. Right? And when those receptors bind particular odors, they send electrical activity via the olfactory nerves. All right, and that's cranial nerve number one, to the temporal lobe where you have the primary cortex for smell. All right, so what bone do these nerves enter your brain? Can you remember what bone? You have the olfactory nerves? Ethmoid bone, that's right. Remember the cribriform plate right there has all those olfactory foramina. So where do I have the sense of smell right here on this slide? This is pretty good. Right, so here is the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone. Here are a bunch of those olfactory nerves. And in order to smell odors that are in the air, those molecules actually have to enter your nose, and you have to kind of like sniff in order to get a good whiff of them, because look where these olfactory nerves are. They're way up on the roof of the nasal cavity right here, and these are where the receptors are. And the number of senses for smell is huge. There are thousands of different kinds of receptors. All right, here are just a few of the primary receptor organs. There are some that you have a sense of flowery, some etheric sense, kind of smells like ether, right? Sweaty is another kind of sense, and a stinging sense would be like an acid smell. And by activating different receptors, then you can kind of tell what you're smelling, if it's like a strawberry or a flower, right, or a hamburger or whatever, depending on how many different components of these different kinds of primary sensations are activated. All right, but we have probably thousands of different kinds of receptor cells. This is just a very partial list of them. All right, so the important thing is to remember that in order to smell something, that odor molecule has to bind to receptors in the nose. The other sort of interesting thing about the olfactory system, this is the only place in the human body where you actually have nerves that are dangling outside of your body. All other nerves are contained inside your body. And as a result, these nerves right here, since they're really outside of your body, they have a really hard life, right? Because anything that you're breathing in passes by these nerves. It could be caustic chemicals, it could be bacteria or viruses, and indeed some infections actually gain entry to your body by binding to these nerves and then find their way into the brain. All right, but these nerves don't last for a very long time, but that's okay because there are stem cells, like this basal cell right here. When these bipolar cells die, then the stem cells replace these neurons altogether. So that's kind of interesting, right? A lot of times nervous tissue in your body doesn't regenerate, but here is one region where they generate every couple weeks because these cells degenerate. And can you recognize this as being a bipolar cell? Here is the cell body, right? And then here is one process, and then here is the other process on the opposite side of the cell body that goes into the olfactory bulb, where here is just a nice multipolar cell that we call a mitral cell, and that goes all the way to the temporal lobe. And this is a group of myelinated axons inside the central nervous system that we call a tract, right? And that would be the olfactory tract. So that's the important thing about the olfactory system. Gustation is the sense of smell. And again, there has to be molecules that bind to receptors, right? And these are going to be on your tongue. So if you look in the mirror and you stick your tongue out, you see a bunch of things sticking off the top of your tongue. And a lot of people call those things taste buds, but those really are not taste buds. Those are just what we call papillae, right? They're like little tips of your finger, except almost microscopic. You can see them with your naked eye. We have some fungiform papillae on the anterior surface, and we have some valate papillae toward the posterior part, and then we even have some other kinds that are way on the posterior part of the tongue. And lining these different papillae, you might have thousands of structures that look like this. Bless you. And this right here is a taste bud. So if we look at a taste bud, I can see a number of cells. All right, so what do you need to see a taste bud? I see a cell. Yeah, you need a microscope, right? So taste buds you can't look at just in the mirror that you have in the bathroom. Those things are papillae, right? You need a microscope to see a taste bud. So you have taste receptor cells right here that have cilia poking off of them, or sometimes we call those taste hairs, that have receptors. And when a molecule binds to that receptor, it starts an electrical signal then that gets picked up by this nerve right here that takes the signals to the brain. Okay, and we have basically four primary taste sensations. We have sweet, salty, bitter, and sweet. And so we can taste all of the things that we're familiar with just by breaking that sensation from that item down into those four basic senses. And guess what? There's actually a fifth one. And that is the sense of deliciousness, right? A fifth kind of receptor, right? And it's called umami. That's a umami receptor which senses amino acids, which are what? The building blocks for proteins. And in particular, one kind of amino acid stimulates this receptor more than any other kind of amino acid, and that's amino acid glutamate, right? So that's why glutamate is added to a lot of foods. It's an artificial additive to food. It's not a sweetener, but what does it add to food when you put glutamate on it? Yeah, it adds deliciousness to food, right? So it gives you the sense that you're eating something worthwhile. Unfortunately, glutamate in some people produces migraine headaches or other kinds of abnormalities if there's a high concentration of it. Okay, so those are the primary taste sensations, sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and maybe even last night you tasted something that had some component of sweet to it and some component of sour and bitter and salty all in one shot, okay, and what was that? Like, how about a margarita? Have you ever tasted a margarita? Not everybody in here has. Probably only a few of you have. But when you drink a margarita, what do you taste? Well, there's salt on the glass, right? And there's sweet in there. There's sour because there's lemon juice and bitter, right? And knowing the right component of each of these, you could identify that as being a margarita, right? And all those compounds have to bind to receptors on these taste cells right here in order for you to appreciate that in your taste cortex. All right, so these are, what kind of senses? General or special senses? Special, that's right. All right, so that's going to take us to vision. All right, and we talked about vision quite a bit in lab, so you know the structure of the eye pretty much. All right, but let's review something, some accessory structures. So accessory structures are parts of your visual system that aren't primarily responsible for vision. Those are going to be the photoreceptor cells, but these just help either protect the eye or help the eye do its job. And so, for instance, some accessory structures will be like eyebrows right here, which prevent foreign bodies from falling from the top of your head and forehead into your eye, right? Or if something does fall down and brushes these hairs, there are sensory fibers on these hair cells. You know something's about to fall on your eye, so what are you going to do? You're going to blink. What are you going to blink? Your eyelids, but what do we call an eyelid? It's a palpebra, right? So here is the superior palpebra. Here's the inferior one right here. So an eyelid is a palpebra. And then we have the angles. Here's the lateral angle of the eye. Here's the medial angle. There's a little caruncle right here, which participates in forming a duct, which takes tears from the surface of the eye down into the nasal cavity. All right, so that shows everything on this slide pretty much, except on this, if we look over here on the right-hand side, we see the eyelashes, which do the same job as the eyebrow, the hairs do, right? It just feels for objects as before they hit your eye so that you can blink. There's some tarsal glands that secrete like an oily fluid that helps prevent the eye from dehydrating, this tarsal gland right here. And there is a membrane that covers the outer surface of the eye and the inner parts of these palpebrae, and that's the conjunctiva, the conjunctival membranes, right? The one that's over the outer surface of the eye, that's called the bulbar conjunctiva, the one that lines the inner eyelid right there, that's the palpebral conjunctiva. And of course, sometimes that's infected by a fairly infectious virus, and that causes pink eye, okay? And that can be transferred from one eye to the other pretty easy just by scratching one eye and then scratching the other eye. Okay, then you have these extrinsic eye muscles. How many extrinsic eye muscles do you have? You should probably know that from lab. There are 6 of them. There are 4 rectus muscles and then 2 oblique muscles. Okay. All right, and then another gland that prevents dehydration or desiccation of the eye, but it also washes away bacteria and fungus and dust particles from your eye, and that's the lacrimal gland right here, which is what on the superior lateral margin of the eye. You have lacrimal ducts, excretory ducts from the lacrimal gland, and those tears then flow over the surface of the eye. Enter the lacrimal punctum right here, near the caruncle, and then through the lacrimal canaliculus into the lacrimal sac and duct, nasal lacrimal duct, finally into your nose, right? And then, I suppose if you sniffle, then you just swallow those tears down, or they dehydrate in your nose as you're breathing, or they run out of your nose as dribble. We just call that dribble, okay? Okay. All right, so those are some accessory structures of the eye, and you're familiar with this picture from lab, so this is an important exam figure, but basically what do we see here? We see the 3 layers of the eye, starting with the superficial layer, that's the sclera, then we got the choroid, which is the vascular part that supplies nutrients to the sclera, as well as supplying nutrients to the deepest layer, which is the retina, and the retina contains photoreceptor cells. All right, so we have 2 kinds of photoreceptor cells, all right, and those photoreceptor cells are rods and cones. And the cone cells are pretty small, so they allow you to see in great detail. They can show you fine detail because they're so small, they're only sensitive to very small areas of light. The rod cells are a lot bigger, so you don't have very good fine detail appreciation with rod cells, but you can see in dim light with rod cells as a result. Cone cells can show you fine detail, but you need to have bright light as a result of that. Also, the rods and cones are different in terms of color vision. The cones allow you to see in color, and the rods only in black and white or shades of gray. So when you look right at something, like I'm looking at you, do I see you in living color or just shades of gray? Living color. It's because light is going right back straight from the anterior pole of my eye to the posterior pole where you have the macula lutea and in the very center, the fovea centralis. The fovea centralis, the center part, is 100% cone cells. Your best vision and color vision occurs right here in the fovea centralis. But what do you need in order to see fine detail and color? Since those cone cells are small, you need a lot of light. You need bright light. As you move away from the fovea centralis into the macula lutea and into peripheral vision, then the cone cells give way to the majority of rod cells. This is where you have your best vision when it's dark outside, but only in shades of gray. right? So you don't have fine detail, but at least you can see a little bit in shades of gray in your peripheral vision of the retina. Okay. So those are the two kinds of cells. Right here, we have the optic nerve. And what cranial nerve is the optic nerve? Two, that's right, cranial. And is that sensory or motor or mixed? It's purely sensory, right? It's a purely afferent nerve taking visual signals from the retina to the visual lobe. And can you remember what lobe of the cerebrum is the visual center? It is the occipital lobe, right? So occipital lobe. And where the optic nerve attaches to the retina, that means that there can't be any photoreceptor cells there. And so we call that the optic disc, which is really the blind spot. So you can't see anything when light falls on that part of your visual field. And maybe some people in lab, I actually drew that diagram on the board, but I should for you guys in lab. Maybe I'll try to remember to do that so you can see your blind spot. All right, then here is a cavity in the posterior part of the eye. We call that the posterior segment. It's filled with that jelly-like material, right, vitreous humor. And the posterior segment stops at the lens. Then there are cavities that are anterior to the lens, and we call that the anterior segment. What's the name of the fluid in that anterior segment? Aqueous humor that's produced by these ciliary processes right here, and it flows between the iris and the lens out through the pupil into this anterior cavity of the anterior segment of the eye, and then it's resorbed by this scleral venous sinus right here. It's returned to the circulatory system. And if too high a pressure builds up in this anterior segment, what disease process is that called? Glaucoma, right? When a too high a pressure builds up in the anterior segment, and that's eventually going to kill the rods and cone cells because that's going to inhibit nutrients from entering the choroid, and the cells, these rods and cones, need a lot of oxygen and nutrients. It's a highly metabolic region right there. All right, so what's the job of the iris that I see right here? It can constrict or it can dilate, right, depending on how bright the light is outside. So if it's like right now, are your pupils dilated or constricted? Is it bright in here or dim in here? It's dim, so your eye needs to let a light in. So that means that your pupil should be dilated, right? And when you walk outside in bright sunlight, it's bright, then the pupil constricts, right? And it helps protect your eye from too much light. Okay. So the iris is dilated and contracting, constricting all the time. There's something else that moves in the eye, and that's the lens. We did this in lab, right? If you put your fingernail in front of you like that and focus on it, your fingernail's in focus, but what about the background? It's blurry. Or if you don't move your finger, if you focus on the background, how's your fingernail? Blurry, right? Both can't be in focus at the same time, only one distance at a time. And the lens actually has to change shape. And you get to pick where you want to focus, on something, a distant object or a near object. And that process of picking where you want to focus, like switching your focus from far away to near away, I mean to near close, all right, what do we call that process? That is accommodation, okay? And that's because the ciliary body is a muscle and it can apply tension or release tension on these suspensory ligaments, changing the shape of the lens. Now, as you get older, what happens to this lens right here? It gets stiff, just like many other parts of your body will as you get older, if you're lucky enough to get older. So, as you get older, you have trouble doing what? Accommodating. Which is what? Focusing on far objects or close objects, but not at the same time. All right, so maybe you were on the 405 freeway this morning, and there was somebody that was going 35 miles an hour, right, in your lane while you were going 70, right? So you could probably tell me about something about that person that was driving 35 miles an hour. What could you tell me about them? They were an older person. Now, why is that? Why is that a really good guess? Because as you get older, you have trouble accommodating, right? It takes longer to accommodate. So if you're 65, 70 years old, There's one thing that you don't ever want to have happen, because you might lose your license. And what's that? Get a ticket, right? For a speeding ticket, right? Because you'll get your license yanked and you might not be able to pass it again. So somebody in that age group, what are you going to be looking at if you don't want to speed? Your speedometer, right? And where's your speedometer? Is it far away or close up? It's close up. So you look at your speedometer, you've accommodated for near vision, and you go, oh, thank God, I'm not speeding. I'm only going 35 in a 75 mile an hour zone. Okay, so you're relieved. But then you think, do I really want to be on the 405 freeway? No. I don't want to miss my exit. And where's the exit? It's down the road. Is it where? Close up by your dashboard or far away? It's far away. So you look up from the speedometer and you look out the windshield, but how does that look? It's blurry because you're focused on your speedometer and you look down the road, everything's blurry. 1001, 1002, and then what happens? It kind of pops into focus, and you can see your exit down the freeway, and you feel what? You're relaxed, right? Parasympathetic nervous system takes over again because you haven't missed your exit yet. But then the sympathetic nervous system kicks in. Now what are you worried about? Are you speeding? Okay, so you look from down the freeway to your dashboard, and what do you see? Blurry. It's all blurry, right? Because now you got to shift to near vision. And that takes what? Accommodation, 1001, 1002, and then all of a sudden the speedometer pops into focus and you can see that you're not speeding, right? And you go, thank God I'm not speeding. But now what are you worried about? Did you miss the exit? You look down the freeway and what do you see? Nothing, and then it pops into focus. Then what are you worried about? Are you speeding? So in that whole process, right, you got to be really careful. You got to drive really slowly. So when you see all those viejitos driving out there, just give them a lot of room. Stay out of their way because they just can't see as well as you do, right? Because of what? Accommodation, because this lens gets stiff, right? Just stay right out of their way. All right, so the lens as well as the cornea right here, both have curvature, both bend light so that it focuses on the retina. The job of the lens is what? To change, is to shift your focus from far away to near. But something that's even more important for focusing is the cornea. The shape of the cornea has to match up to the distance from the cornea to the retina right here. And that's what is adjusted, for instance, if somebody gets a LASIK procedure. Because they can reshape the cornea to match the distance. Some people's eyeballs are too long, some are too short, and the curvature of the cornea here can be matched up to that distance so that things focus exactly on the retina instead of in front of it if the eyeball is too long, or behind it if the eyeball is too short. And we kind of talked about that in lab too, so I don't think I want to go over that. All right, so the tunics of the eye. The fibrous tunic, right, contains the sclera, which also includes the cornea. The cornea, of course, is modified to where it doesn't have a lot of tough connective tissue like the white regions of the sclera. It is what? Clear, so that light can enter. The vascular tunic includes the choroid right here, all right, and the iris and the ciliary body. And then the sensory tunic, right, contains the neural layer that has those photoreceptor cells. And there are even some pigmented cells in there, like melanocytes, that help absorb light after it stimulates the rods and cone cells so that it doesn't bounce around or flash around inside your eyeball. All right, so those are the sensory tunics. All right, so that's vision, okay, which takes us to hearing. All right, actually takes us to the ear. And the ear, let's look at the slide on the right over here. The ear actually has three senses, right? It has hearing, number one, and it also has balance. There are two kinds of balance. There's something called static equilibrium, and then there's something called kinetic equilibrium, all having to do with the ear. But what we're going to look at first is the sense of hearing, which is the ear. All right, so let's go to ear. Here's a pretty good diagram of the ear. And when you think of the ear, you automatically should think of three main regions. There is an external ear, a middle ear, and an internal ear. The external ear starts with the auricle, right here. Sometimes it's called the pinna. Here's your earlobe. Here's the helix of the ear. Right, that helps focus sound energy into the external acoustic meatus. This is all part of the external ear. And that sound energy is a physical wave. It's a mechanical wave that can actually apply force to different objects. That's why if you have a speaker at home that generates sound, what is that speaker doing? It's vibrating back and forth, actually hitting the air, pressurizing air molecules so that you can hear them. So it's a nice physical mechanical wave. And when that wave bumps up against the tympanic membrane right here, which is what we call the eardrum, what is that going to do? It's going to vibrate back and forth, right? So that's the endpoint of the external ear, which means that the tympanic membrane is also the beginning of the middle compartment of the ear. Okay, so the tympanic membrane is relatively large compared to a membrane that takes sound energy to the inner part of the ear right here. Look at this membrane. This is what we call the oval window. It's relatively small. Right, so the surface area of the tympanic membrane is large, the oval window is small. That acts as a system of amplification because it's hard, it's difficult for sound energy to go from air into fluid, which is found in the inner compartments of the ear right here. So I don't know if you've ever been swimming, okay? You could have a conversation with somebody if your head is above water, but if your head is below water and somebody's talking to you, guess what? You can't really hear them. You might be able to look up and see them on the deck of the pool and they're talking to you, but you can't really hear them because sound energy doesn't like to go into fluid. So there has to be a level of amplification between the tympanic membrane and the oval window. Another level of amplification takes place because there are bones, three bones in the middle ear, and because of their angulation, when the tympanic membrane vibrates, the vibration of the oval window right here is accentuated as well. So that acts as another amplifier. These three bones are the malleus, the incus, and stapes. So they carry the vibrations across the middle part of the ear to the inner ear right here. All right. So this tympanic membrane shouldn't have a lot of static pressure or unchanging pressure on one side or the other. For instance, if you're at sea level and you start to drive up into the mountains, what happens to the air pressure as you drive up into the mountains? It decreases, right? So if you have high pressure in the middle ear and low pressure out in the air, then this tympanic membrane is going to get pushed into the external acoustic meatus, and it could get pushed all the way to the end. And if it gets pushed to the end of its excursion, guess what? It can't vibrate anymore. And if it can't vibrate, guess what? You can't hear anything, right? Another circumstance, too, maybe you're in an airplane and you're up at really high altitude and then you land, and as you land, right, then the pressure in your external acoustic meatus gets really, really high and it pushes the eardrum all the way into this low pressure region right here, and it gets pushed to the side and again it can't vibrate. So what do you do when you can't hear because there's unequal pressure on either side of the eardrum? You can yawn or you can swallow, you know, maybe you can pull on your little tragus right here, part of the ear, to open up a little passageway that goes from the middle ear to your throat, which is what we call your pharynx, and that's called the pharyngotympanic tube. Sometimes it's called the auditory tube, sometimes it's called the eustachian tube, right? And that helps equalize pressure across the tympanic membrane, because when tympanic membrane gets pushed one way or the other to an extreme degree, that's also very painful, all right? So I don't know if you ever travel with little kids, which can usually have infections of the middle ear right here. That means they can't clear their ears because this auditory tube is plugged up. And so when they fly on an airplane, how are they behaving during takeoff or during landing when there are extremes of pressure across the eardrum? Yeah, sometimes they're crying, and if it hurts really bad, they're really screaming their head off because why? Well, it hurts like hell, right? It hurts really, really bad. And so for us, we can take cold medication, like decongestants and things like that, that can help us, but I wouldn't recommend that you give a one-year-old a lot of cold medicine, right? Talk with your physician if you're going to fly with an infant, what kind of medication you can take if they have an ear infection, for instance. All right, so you got outer ear. You got middle ear with the auditory ossicles that have to vibrate back and forth and the eustachian tube which equalizes pressure. And that eventually then enters the inner ear. And this is, oh, what bone in the skull is this right here? Is that the frontal bone? Parietal bone? Temporal bone, yeah, temporal bone, because that's where your external acoustic meatus is. All right, and then you have some nerves like right here, the vestibulocochlear nerve, which leaves the internal acoustic meatus. But notice that the internal acoustic meatus doesn't go all the way through, doesn't connect up to the external acoustic meatus, because there's a lot of stuff in between. All right, and this is in the petrous region of the temporal bone, that thick region of the temporal bone. There is a bony labyrinth that is containing the organs for the two senses of equilibrium and hearing. All right, so this part right here that looks like a snail, that's what we call the cochlea. Right, and it's a bony structure for hearing. The vestibule is right here. This is for the sense of linear acceleration. And then we have three semicircular canals right here for the sense of kinetic equilibrium. All right, so those are the three senses. So let's look at what figure. Let's talk about hearing right now. So we're going to be interested in the cochlea. Now, when I look at the cochlea, to me, it really looks like a musical instrument. Why is that? And what musical instrument is it? Okay. To me, it really looks like a piano. Okay. And piano has a set of keys on it, and if you push keys on one end of the piano, it makes a high note, and if you push keys on the other end of the piano, it makes a low note, and if you push a key in the middle, it makes what? Like a mid-range note in between. All right, so the same thing for the cochlea. You should think of the cochlea, right, as just a big, long structure, and why is it all curled up? Why is it all rolled up? Well, because it looked really silly if you had these cochlea sticking out of your heads, right? So evolution has figured out a way to roll them up so that they fit nice and neat inside your inner ear. And it's basically a piano. When this part of the cochlea vibrates, it produces a sensation of a high frequency. When the tip end over here vibrates, which we call the helicotrema, right? When this region right here vibrates, we hear a low frequency, all right? And that's because of the shape of the organ that's in this part of the cochlea. All right, in a piano, what strings make a low frequency? Can you tell me something about their thickness and their length? Okay, just like a guitar, all right, they're the thick strings that vibrate slowly. It produces a low frequency. And in a piano, to even make it a greater range than a guitar, those strings are also a lot longer, right? So in a piano, they're the long, thick strings. And what about the high frequencies? Those are short, thin strings that vibrate at a faster frequency. All right. So this part of the cochlea right here is really thick. You can't see it on this diagram, but this is the thick part of the cochlea that just has a natural tendency, just like strings in a piano, to vibrate at a low frequency. This is the thin part of the cochlea right here, which has a tendency to vibrate at a high frequency. All right, so sound comes in. The external acoustic meatus vibrates the tympanic membrane, works through the auditory ossicles, which then produces sound through the oval window, which then enters this fluid right here. All right, so this fluid we call perilymph. And this little chamber is what we call the scala vestibuli. So now we have the sound energy inside the cochlea, and it's going to move across this inner compartment right here that we call the cochlear duct. The cochlear duct has got what we call endolymph, a different kind of fluid in it, as well as the sense organ for sound. And when it does, it vibrates that sense organ, and it goes into the endolymph right here in the scala tympani. Is it labeled? Oh yeah, here it is, scala tympani. All right, now that sound has to leave the cochlea, because if it gets trapped in there, it could damage some of these membranes. Right, so that's energy entering your ear, and your ear should release it, and then it's released by the round window. So what kind of window allows sound to enter the cochlea? It is the oval window, because look at the footprint of the stapes right here. It is oval, right? And in the models in lab, We see a nice circular dot right here that represents the round window. That's how the energy is released from the cochlea so that it doesn't blow up. Okay, so you have the scala vestibuli, the scala tympani, and then the cochlear duct, which contains the organ for hearing right in this region right here. So let's look and see something about that organ for hearing. Nope, that's not it. That's not it. This is it right here. All right, so here is the cochlea that's all been wound up on each other. This is basically what? Like that piano. We can do a transverse section through it, and this is what the transverse section is going to look at. All right, so we have those three different ducts. We have a duct that's connected to the tympanic membrane, which is this one right here. This is the scala vestibuli. Here is the cochlear duct, and then here's the scala tympani over here, which is connected to the round window. Do you see a round window? I don't see a round window. And then this right here is the organ that's necessary for hearing. So sound is going to go from the tympani into the vestibuli, going across this organ right here that we call the organ of Corti. Let's see what that, let's zoom into the organ of Corti. All right, so here is the scala vestibuli. Sound enters, moves across, and then into the scala tympani, and then out to the round window. And as sound moves across this cochlear duct right here, guess what happens? This whole thing vibrates up and down, including, okay, this tectorial membrane. So we want to focus in on this thing right here. This is what we call the organ of Corti. So the organ of Corti is important for what kind of sense?
Hearing,
that's right, for hearing. So let's zoom into this region right here. All right, so this is the cochlear duct. Here's the tectorial membrane that will vibrate up and down. And we can see that it's attached to these cilia that are on these, we call these are special cells, receptor cells for hearing, and we call them hair cells because it has these cilia on top of them. All right, so these really aren't like hairs that you have growing on the top of your head. These are just special cilia that attach to the tectorial membrane. And when these hairs or stereocilia bend, it starts electrical activity in the hair cells, which then transmits that electrical activity to fibers of the cochlear nerve, which then go to the auditory cortex in your brain. And the auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe. And inside your temporal lobe, you have like two pianos as well. So you have some cells in one end of the temporal cortex that when they depolarize, receive electrical signals, you perceive a low sound, and some on the other side, you'll perceive a high sound, high frequency sound. And those nerves originate in different parts of the organ of Corti. All right, so this right here is the basilar membrane, which doesn't vibrate, but this one right here is the tectorial membrane. This is the one that does vibrate. So you have perilymph up here, perilymph down over here, and then endolymph within the cochlear duct. So what kind of cells are responsible for hearing? What are the receptor cells called? Yeah, the hair cells that have these stereocilia on them. Okay, so you have hair cells. All right, so that's for the sense of hearing. The other sense, let's see if I left anything out. No, not really. Okay, let's talk about the sense of balance. We either got static equilibrium or kinetic equilibrium. Where is that located at? Okay, right here. All right, so we're looking at what we call the bony labyrinth in the inner ear. What is this one right here that looks like a snail? What do we call this bony labyrinth? This is the cochlea. All right, here is the vestibule. This is what's important for the sense of static equilibrium or linear acceleration. All right, so look on the slide on the right. Static equilibrium or linear acceleration. Now, what the heck does acceleration mean? Okay. Acceleration is a term that's used when you're changing velocity. Okay, so going from 0 to 60, you're accelerating. right? Or going from 60 to 70 miles an hour. That is accelerating. But if you stay moving at 60 miles an hour, right, and then stay at 60 miles an hour again, there's no acceleration or deceleration, right? You're just going at the same velocity. So your velocity has to change, right, in a linear way. And there are some sense organs in the vestibule that can sense that. And you have two of them. One is the utricle and the other is the saccule. And if we look at these organs right here, right, that we call maculae, there is a gelatinous mass, and then sitting on top of this gelatinous mass are these crystals. So you actually have crystals in the macula on both sides of your head in the vestibule. And these are calcium carbonate crystals that act as little weights. And guess what gravity does with weight? It pulls down on it, right? And this gelatinous mass can deform. And here you have some hair cells that have stereocilia poking up into this gelatinous mass so that when the gelatin deforms, it bends the stereocilia, and that sends a signal to the brain that you're accelerating in one direction or another in a linear way. All right, so what does that look like? So here you have, for instance, with your head straight up, and the gelatin is just pushing down, but it's not bending the stereocilia. But if you bend your head forward, look what happens to this gelatinous mass. The otoliths kind of pull it down and pull the stereocilia with them, which then starts electrical signals in these receptor cells. Oh, what do we call these receptor cells for linear acceleration? These are hair cells. Where else did you run into hair cells? Those were the receptor cells that were part of the organ of Corti. So they're very, very similar cells, except you have a much different sense. So when your head changes position, right, because gravity acts as acceleration, you can feel, you can sense what position your head is in. Okay, so that's for linear acceleration, or what we call static equilibrium. All right, so the bony labyrinth, let's go over these things. Maybe next time I'll put on the board a nice table. All right, so the bony labyrinth for linear acceleration is the vestibule. The organs for sensing that would be the maculae. All right, and what's the receptor cell? It's the hair cell right here. Okay, and don't forget that the sense for linear acceleration is due to these otoliths pushing down on this membrane right here. All right, so that takes us to our third sense, right, which has to do with the semicircular canals. The semicircular canals right here is what we call the bony labyrinth for what kind of equilibrium sense? It is kinetic equilibrium. And what sense is that? It has to do with acceleration, but not linear acceleration. It has to do with angular acceleration. What's angular acceleration? Like spinning, okay, when you start to rotate. Now you have three of these semicircular canals, so that organ can give you a sense of spinning in how many different directions? Yeah, three different directions. And how many directions make up space? Right, left, up, down, forward, and backwards, right? Three dimensions. So you can tell exactly where you're spinning in space because you have three spinning sense organs. And those organs right here are what we call the crista ampullaris. All right, so the organ for hearing is the organ of Corti. The organs for linear acceleration are the maculae, but the organs for angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium are the crista ampullae. And they're at the base of each of the semicircular canals. There's like a little bulge right here that's called an ampule. And so that's why this is called the crista ampullaris. And if we focus at this one layer right here, let's zoom into that little ampule that contains the crista ampullaris. Here you have a gelatinous mass that we call the cupula. And down in this basal membrane right here, we have some more hair cells with stereocilia poking up into this gelatinous mass. And when the cupula bends backwards or forwards, it causes the bending of these stereocilia, which then send electrical signals into the vestibular nerve, which then takes it to your sense for equilibrium inside your brain. All right. So what I have to describe to you when we start next time is this endolymph. There's a fluid right here, and it has mass, and mass has a property of inertia. This is the last concept that I want to tell you about today. What does inertia mean for something that has mass? Like, for instance, this Coca-Cola right here has mass. It has inertia. What does this mean? And you're going to do this on Thanksgiving to really show off. So you're going to have what? A table with turkey and wine glasses and a candelabra with lots of candles and stuff like that. And everybody's going to sit down and you're going to walk up to the table and say, I want to show you a nice magic trick. I want to demonstrate inertia to you. I'm going to pull the tablecloth out from underneath everything without disturbing anything on the table. Right? And so what are people going to do? They're going to get really excited and get ready to clap because they know that you can do it just like that. Right? Inertia means that if something has mass, it doesn't like to move. It likes to stay stationary. It takes a lot of force to move something. Right? So inertia means something doesn't like to get moving. But inertia means something else too. That when mass is in motion, when you get something to move, what does it like to do? It likes to stay moving. It doesn't like to stop. That's the other corollary to inertia. So for instance, if I start slowly and move really fast, and I stop all of a sudden, what's going to happen to my Coke bottle? It's going to keep moving, right? Ooh, like that. So my Coke bottle is going to be the endolymph inside the ear. When your head is stationary, what does that endolymph like to do? Stay stationary, but if you're spinning for a long period of time, what does that endolymph like to do? It likes to stay spinning around in this semicircular canal. All right, so we're going to use this principle to explain angular acceleration and how it affects crista ampullaris, right, which we all used to do when we were little kids. Or maybe you did last night. You do what? You start spinning around and then you stop all of a sudden, and then what happens to your reality? It keeps spinning around because the endolymph is still spinning and it's pushing on the cupula here, and that gives you a sense that of dysphoria, right, when that endolymph is spinning. So we got to finish up with this next time, and maybe I got to say a few other things about hearing, but that's it for special senses. Then we're going to move on to heart. And here is the sign-in sheet.